You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin is in for more harsh winter weather this week. We'll learn about what's in store and how to prepare for the cold and snowy days ahead. First, taxpayer-funded pensions for members of Congress could become a thing of the past under recently proposed legislation from two Republican senators. The End Pensions in Congress Act, or EPIC Act, comes in response to the longest government shutdown in American history. Instead of pensions, lawmakers would instead have to rely on their thrift savings plans, essentially a government equivalent of a 401k. While the legislation probably has a slim chance of passing, there have been other calls to cut lawmakers' pay or prevent senators and congressional representatives from collecting paychecks during government shutdowns. Michael Hiltzik is a business columnist for the Los Angeles Times. His recent column on this issue is titled, "Here's Why Congress Deserves a Pay Raise." Yes, a raise. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. It's good to be on with you.
Well, let's talk about this EPIC Act, the End Pensions in Congress Act. Two Republican senators, Rick Scott and Mike Braun. What was your reaction to the introduction of that bill?
My immediate reaction is that this is a sort of cynical proposal that you would expect from these two guys, both of whom are multimillionaires. Scott, in particular, made his money at a company that he led that was guilty of a spectacular fraud against the federal government. So I'm not sure anybody really wants to rely on them for proposals with any integrity.
The big thing is, I think a lot of people look at Congress and say they don't get much done. The bums in Congress is a old American standby. So why pay them a lot? Why pay them well? Why give them pensions if they're not producing, I guess?
Sure. Well, that's a good question. And you're right. This is a very common sort of trope or meme among the public that these guys are do-nothings, they're lazy, they're just at the public trough. We all know all of the lines. The fact is that you don't want your federal legislators, just as you don't really want your state legislators, to be living in penury or pinching pennies, because you want to be able to attract people from all walks of life to these jobs. You don't want the jobs to go only to people who can afford to do them because they are low-wage jobs. You want people who, you know, for whom this is a good wage, maybe even a better wage than they're getting in their daily lives, because you want people who actually come from the middle class and the working class to want to serve in Congress or in your state legislature.
Is there a bias toward wealthier people getting into Congress and the Senate, even with their current levels of pay and their potential pension benefits?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that the two chambers of Congress, especially the Senate, have become plutocrat havens. I think the last time that the median net worth of U.S. senators was calculated, and I think that goes back to 2015, the median net worth was something like $3.2 million. The median net worth of members of Congress, that is to say representatives, was something in the neighborhood of $900,000 or maybe a million, and that was back in 2015. It's probably a little bit higher now, but some members of Congress are billionaires. Do we really want our lawmakers to be drawn entirely from that class? My argument was, I don't think so.
Talking to Michael Hiltzik, business columnist at the Los Angeles Times, looking at a proposal to cut pensions for members of Congress and the U.S. Senate. Michael, you broke down how much or what it takes to get these pensions and how many people are using them. Can you tell us what some of the numbers are?
Sure. There are two different pension, that's to say defined benefit pensions, classic pensions, as many workers understand them. These are the sorts of pensions that are going away in the private sector, but there are two different systems that have to do with when the members of Congress served. For those served prior to 1984, they get one system that pays somewhat better. For those elected after 1984, they get another system The older members, they're receiving an average annual pension, that is the retirees, of about $74,000 a year. Those in the later system are earning or collecting an average of about $41,000. And as I pointed out, that is higher than the median private pension in the country, which is about $9,300 a year, or even the average federal employee pension, which is about $22,000. But let's not forget that members of Congress are better paid than most working Americans. They're getting $174,000 a year to serve in Washington.
That's members of the House. What is it? What does a gig like the U.S. Senate pay year to year?
Well, the Senate and House members all get the same annual salary of $174,000.
Have there been a lot of calls? Has it been a political football over the decades, arguments about pay raises, pensions, and other benefits for members of Congress?
Yeah, I think this is sort of a perennial, and we see it not only at the federal level, but at the state level and even the local level. I mean, I've certainly been at school board meetings or, local town and village meetings where members of the public will stand up and say, why should we pay our teachers X or our city councilman Y, because that's more than I earn. And I've never thought that was a particularly convincing argument. I mean, the argument from, resentment isn't really very powerful. But at the federal level, yeah, we see this every so often. I wrote about this the first time around. I wrote about it in 2013, so that was 6 years ago, when there was a similar groundswell to say, let's cut these guys' salaries. And we tend to see it often at times, as it was then in 2013, and I think as it is now, when there's a government shutdown. So rank-and-file government workers, they're not getting paid, and the question is, well, why should the legislators get paid? They're the ones responsible for the shutdown. And I have to say there's some justification for that. I mean, in a case where you've got members of Congress who are distinctly doing nothing about a particular issue that involves pay, especially for pay for federal workers, then I think it's fair to say, you know, why are you getting paid when you're depriving your own employees of pay? But in general, I'm not sure you want to make that argument.
Right. Senator Mike Braun had also back in January, that reminds me, introduced something called the No Budget, No Pay Act, which would have done what you just said. If there's a shutdown because Congress can't arrive at a budget, congressional salaries would stop until the shutdown is ended. Would that be an incentive to avoid unpleasant shutdowns?
Well, I think given the politics in Washington over the last few years, that would mean that nobody got paid ever, because they don't pass budgets anymore. They pass these continuing resolutions. I'm not sure you really want to put that sort of artificial pressure on lawmakers to come to a given outcome, because you may not get the outcome you want. You may get something that's just cranked through in order to end the immediate controversy so they can get paid. And that's not necessarily going to be the best considered budget that you want at the federal level. So I think we have to pick and choose what circumstances we want to impose a pay freeze or dock pay for federal lawmakers. I would say a government shutdown, yeah, you can probably make the case for that, but forcing them to do something that really is within their general job description, I don't really think you want to do that.
We're talking about proposed legislation that would end taxpayer-funded pensions for members of Congress and the overall issue of lawmaker pay. Michael Hiltzik is our guest. He's a reporter and columnist for the Los Angeles Times, a business columnist there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should lawmakers have pensions funded by taxpayers, in effect? What do you think of the idea of cutting lawmaker pay or cutting off salaries during a government shutdown? Do you worry that if the pay is too low, the concerns our guest raised, only wealthy people would be able to run for and stay in office? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Michael Hiltzik, business columnist for Los Angeles Times. We're talking about pensions and pay for members of Congress. Two Republican senators are looking to end pensions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would getting rid of pensions or cutting lawmaker pay be good for government? Do you see unintended negative consequences? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls now, Jeff is with us in Appleton. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there. I guess in my way of thinking, a pension is kind of a reward for a long career at some place. And I think that's kind of indicative of the problem we have with our legislators. They're treating legislative positions as a career. And term limits, along with getting rid of the pension, I think are both good steps. I cannot think of a single bad thing that could happen by limiting terms and getting rid of pensions.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Michael, Jeff worried that, lawmakers are career legislators, and he's worried about the impact of that. What do you think?
Yeah, I can tell you, coming from a state that has very strict term limits on the state legislature, I would have to say that term limits are a terrible idea. What we've seen in California is that you end up with a legislature in which the lawmakers, just at the point that they actually learn how to do their jobs, these are not simple jobs, they're not easy jobs, although that's certainly the public impression, but they have to know stuff. They have to build up a body of knowledge, and in this state, just at the point that that happens, they're basically term limited out. And what happens when you have that sort of situation is that lobbyists take over, because lobbyists are the ones who actually spend their careers building up knowledge and information in a particular field, and they're the ones that legislators end up turning to get information. That's not a healthy situation. You want legislators who know their work. You want legislators who know the issues. Sure, there are some who maybe have run out their string, who've served too long. But look, every 2 years, voters can turf out a member of the House of Representatives, and every 6 years they can vote out a member of the Senate. Nothing stopping the voters from firing legislators who they don't think is doing the work. I think these sorts of artificial term limits, they do not work. They're always bad, and they're not a good idea.
Thanks for that call. Going out to Romero in Madison. Hello, what do you think?
Hi. I have one question here. Earlier in the program, you had said that, you know, there are a lot of people who are poor that really can't run for office, you know, like a Congress or a senator, because, you know, there's a huge disparity there. So, you know, right now we have people calling for free, you know, education as far as the university system goes. So how do you justify that? Like, can we make, you know, free education so that, you know, we get poor people, you know, more of a chance to get into Congress and into Senate?
Romero, thanks. So the priority of the money, spending our money, maybe not so much on compensation for lawmakers, but things that can lift up poor, lower-income people, he's saying, so they'd have a shot at doing something like that. Michael.
Yeah, I think in a way the caller makes a good point, but it's maybe not the point that he was trying to make. The fact is that one of the reasons that we don't have a lot of support at the State House or on Capitol Hill for a lot of these programs that will help lift up the working class or lower-income people is that the legislators we have aren't familiar with their lifestyles. They're not familiar. They don't come from that milieu anymore, not when their median income is $3 million. If we had a way to incentivize working class Americans and lower income Americans to run for office, then I think we would end up with Congress and the Senate that was closer, that reflected closer the real way that people live, and they would be much more sensitive to these sorts of needs. And I think we see that also in the approach to Social Security on Capitol Hill. There seems to be a lot of hostility to Social Security by some members of Congress, and that's because most of them don't really have to worry about living on Social Security when they retire. They do get a nice pension, or they have an enormous net worth. Look, Rick Scott's net worth, that's one of the senators who's pushing this idea, his net worth is $230 million. He doesn't have to worry about living on Social Security. He doesn't have to worry about his children needing free college. He's got it knocked. So he's got no incentive to push for the sorts of policies that your caller thinks are necessary, that we all think are necessary.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Michael Hiltzik is with us from Los Angeles Times talking about congressional compensation, what members of Congress and the Senate get paid, their pensions, a couple of Republican senators introducing legislation to end the pension system for members of Congress. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jeff joins us in Superior. Jeff, hello.
Hello, thank you. I believe that you may know the answer to my question. What is the total compensation package? You say that congressmen and senators get the same salary, but don't they get a per diem, and then there's a budget that they have for their staff, and then they get travel expenses, and doesn't the government pay toward their Social Security, and is there workers' compensation that pays? So really, they get paid much more than $174,000. I mean, they have that much more money available.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Michael, you broke some of that down in your column. Do you have some of those numbers to hand?
Yeah, sure. Well, the government pays for the employer's share of Social Security for senators and congressmen and all of their staffs, as private employers do for their employees. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill, they get health care. They actually pay into their health care, just as many of us in the private sector do. They actually, because of the way the law was written, they actually have to get their health coverage through Obamacare, even though it was really not designed for people who were employed, but they do that. And they do get, they don't get a per diem so much, but they do get an office budget. The allowances average, and I did break this down, to about $1.3 million a year for House members and $4.24 million for senators. But out of that, they have to pay for their staff. They do have to pay for travel to their home districts, and the annual expenses vary depending on how far Washington is from their districts. They have to pay for mail. They have to pay for all sorts of office expenses. So yeah, they do get these allowances, but they don't really get anything for free. They get office expenses, and once they get the sum, it's up to them to decide how to apportion it among staff members or mail or travel. But yeah, sure. I mean, your caller is absolutely right. They do get these other things, but they also pay into their health coverage and they pay into their Social Security.
Jeff, thanks for the call. We heard from Stephen Brookfield, who says, if you don't pay salaries for elected officials and their pension, you open the door for more corruption. Do you see that as a concern, Michael?
Yeah, I do, and I mentioned that as well. I mean, the two main reasons that you want to make sure that you're paying your lawmakers adequately is, first of all, as I said, you don't want them all coming from the millionaire class. But second of all, you want to reduce the incentive that they have to see their work in Congress as just a stepping stone to being very, very well paid as lobbyists or in some other walk of life like that. And because of that, if they're thinking ahead to getting a job lobbying Congress, then there's a real danger of their taking steps while they are in Congress to sort of grease the way for their future jobs. You want to discourage that as much as possible.
I think there's a perception, and people might argue maybe a reality, that that's happening now anyway with the current compensation system. We do end up seeing a lot of former lawmakers and other government officials ending up working for some kind of lobbying or advocacy firms.
Well, that's certainly true, and I think there is a significant gap even at $174,000 a year. Plus, some of the members of Congress do get a little bit more for leadership positions, including being speaker and what have you. There's a gap between that salary and what they can earn in an average lobbying job, which I think can be $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 or even more. It depends on how valuable they are and maybe how much they've done for a lobbying agency while they've been in Congress. So I don't think you can ever really close that gap, but you can, I think, narrow it significantly so that not everybody who goes to Washington as a member of Congress or as a senator is just thinking ahead to leaving a job on Capitol Hill and moving over to K Street.
Now, your piece on this was headlined, "Here's Why Congress Deserves a Pay Raise." Yes, a raise. For that to happen, I think it has to happen through legislation. And it seems like if you introduce or support a pay raise for a member of Congress, you've just basically written your next opponent's attack ad against you. Is this something that is likely to actually happen?
Well, it's hard to say. There are ways to do it so that the actual members of Congress who are voting can sort of hide behind procedure. I mean, first of all, the law says, in fact, the Constitution says that they cannot vote a pay raise for themselves that takes place in the year or in the Congress that they voted. In other words, if Congress were to vote a pay raise for House and Senate members that took effect this year or next year, that wouldn't be legal. It would have to take effect the following year after a congressional election. But there have also been proposals to tie congressional salaries to the federal wage scale. You would designate members of Congress as GS something or other, instead of actually saying, you know, we're going to get paid this much. And then every time there's a raise, a general raise for federal employees, it would kick in at some level for them also. So I think you could say, it would be hard to say that they were voting themselves directly a raise. I mean, you could say, well, they've given a raise to federal employees, and that includes themselves, so that's bad. But I think that would be a diluted argument against it.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
That's Michael Hiltzik, business columnist for the Los Angeles Times, joining us to talk about congressional pay and pensions. Coming up, the number of births in Wisconsin fell to the lowest level in more than 40 years. We'll learn what's driving that and what it could mean for the future. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, we've heard a lot about a pay gap between men and women. Kate Archer Kent's guest goes to the top of the economic ladder to see how men and women in the top 1% of income levels compare with each other. It's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Wisconsinites are bracing for another round of cold and snowy weather this week. A storm is expected to bring at least 2 inches of snow. Some areas of the state could see an additional 5. Our next guest is here to talk about the weather this week and the overall winter compared to past years. Tim Halbach is warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service office in Milwaukee, Sullivan. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, from what I'm seeing, it's not a real hard storm coming, but what are we looking at over the next few days around the state?
Yeah, well, we've got a couple rounds of light to moderate snow that is expected to come through. The first one we're seeing is already started up here and is mainly affecting kind of the northeast half of, if you were to kind of cut Wisconsin in half from northwest to southeast. That's where the heaviest snowfall is expected for this one. Generally, a 2 to 5 inch type snowfall, which is right when we would issue like a winter weather advisory, and that's what you're seeing for the northeastern part of the state. We didn't have a couple more rounds of snow possible through the rest of the week. There's another system on Friday, which a few days ago had looked like it was going to be a little bit more of potential impacts to us, but the trend has been for that to look weaker and weaker. So just potentially a few more inches with that system and then colder going into next week.
Now, my perception of this winter, Tim, is that we've had two winters, this really fairly mild one for a big chunk there, and then all of the winter in, what, the past 4 weeks ago, where we keep getting some more snow here, some really cold weather there. Am I right? Is this how it's worked out?
Yeah, and that's, you know, when you look back on the record books for past winters, it's kind of interesting when you start comparing what this winter will kind of look like compared to the other ones, if you look strictly at snowfall and average temperatures for this winter period, we're actually pretty close to normal, about as near normal as you can be for temperatures, because it was so warm in December and the early part of January. But then it's like we've had basically all of the winter in the past 6 weeks. But if you compare that to some of the past winters that we've had, and it actually looks either similar to the winter that we had last year, where that one actually looked like it was a little bit colder. But then 16-17 and 15-16, those were both warmer than normal and had less snowfall. So kind of the more recent benchmark for really strong winters was the 2013-2014 season, when it was basically cold from October all the way into spring.
Now, this last weekend really spelled out how local conditions can really vary from place to place. One county, driving's fine. The next county over, they're saying stay off the roads. And then we had this bizarre, huge accident, the 100-plus car pileup in the Neenah area. Sadly, one fatality, a bunch of injuries. How hard is it to spot what is going to be a dangerous driving day from, one town, one county to the next?
Yeah, and, in some spots, it's almost more dangerous when it's very localized like that. If you think back to, we had a dense fog pileup that happened over in Ozaukee County on I-43 a number of years ago. It wasn't a widespread dense fog type day. It was one little low spot along the interstate that had quite a bit of dense fog that formed there, and when the cars would drive in and the accident started, you drive into it not seeing it, and you'd all of a sudden be right upon it, and unfortunately, that's when those worst types of accidents happen. So what you saw up in the Fox Valley yesterday, I think there's probably a lot of people that were driving back from up north that were leaving those horrible conditions that they were seeing everywhere. And then you get to some wide open spaces where all of a sudden the roads are a little bit better, and you start maybe accelerating a little bit more than you had been doing in the past to try to make up some time. And you look at some of the video, it looked like one spot where all of a sudden it was just pure whiteout conditions. And that's something that we try to do, a job of trying to message people and let them know, here's what we're expecting to occur. There's going to be some localized spots where there's going to be some blowing and drifting snow where it's going to be difficult. So that's the message we typically are saying, watch your speeds and try to watch out for these localized areas where it could be blowing like that.
And I think a lot of times we might hear, oh, just an inch or two, or just 2 to 5 inches. It's Wisconsin. That's not bad driving. Leave us with a message for drivers coming into this next couple of storm fronts.
Well, I think, over the past few weeks, we've had quite a bit of practice with the light snows and all that. So obviously, the best thing you can do is just give yourself a lot more time to reach your destination. The snow for today is going to be coming into tonight, so by tomorrow morning the roads will probably be pretty slick as well. So just give yourself a little extra time. You're not going to be able to drive at the speeds that you might normally be able to do to get to work.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Yeah, anytime.
That's Tim Halbach, Warning Coordination Meteorologist for the National Weather Service Office in Milwaukee Sullivan. He joined us with an update on some of the latest winter weather. Coming up, Wisconsin's birth rate appears to be on the decline. We'll learn what that means for the future coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. New data released by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services show that there were fewer than 65,000 babies born in Wisconsin in 2017. It's the first time since the early 1970s that the number of births dipped to those levels. Our next guest is here to talk about those figures and what they mean for the future of the state. David Egan Robertson is an applied demographer with the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory and UW-Madison's Department of Community and Environmental Sociology. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me back.
All right, I hear this raw number now, very low number of births going back to the 70s, but I've got to imagine our population is higher now than it was then. So if I'm doing the math right, that means the birth rate is dropping even more compared to the early 70s.
That's right. Yeah, in addition to the state rate falling for the first time below 65,000 births since the early 70s. A common rate we calculate is called the total fertility rate, and that takes into account, it's kind of a one-number summary as to what's going on in each calendar year, taking the number of births divided by women in different age ranges, of particularly during the reproductive years, or age 15 through 44 in particular. So that rate has actually also fallen below 1.8, and that is as low as it's been since about 1983. Both the number of births has fallen 10%, and the rate as well has fallen about 10%.
Now, with demography, I mean, this is the sum total of lots and lots of individual decisions and choices and variations. But big picture, do we have ideas about why this birth rate and the number of births have gone down?
Yeah. I mean, those of us who do applied demography, we're a bit like, tugboats, and we're pushing ocean liners, you know? It kind of has that feeling. Is it, you know, we're just really observing sort of these broad, national patterns, in some way, really international patterns. There's been some research recently that's actually come out of a retirement center. They were actually looking at fertility, which sounds a little unusual, but they are also looking at, okay, how many people are we going to have in the future to support the Social Security program? And two interesting findings that they came up with is, in particular, what has reduced the rate, especially nationally — they were doing obviously a national level study — was the drop in the fertility rate among Hispanics or Latinos, and as well, what they're finding is that as American society becomes more secular, that a large influence on the birth rate is just people who no longer say that they are affiliated with any religion.
And I should ask, you just mentioned the national trends. Are we unique and weird here in Wisconsin with what we're seeing? Are we tracking what's going on around the country pretty well?
No. I mean, not at all. I mean, yeah, the number of births have fallen. What demographers are using currently as kind of a high water mark was the year 2007, which was the year before the Great Recession started, both in Wisconsin and in the United States. That was like a high point of births. And so Wisconsin has fallen by 11% since 2007 in the number of births, but nationally it's been a 9% drop. We have a lot of company out of the 50 states plus District of Columbia, 49 states that had fewer births in 2017 than they did in 2007.
Is it common to see an economic downturn affect demography like this, affect the number of births?
Yes. Oh, yes. It's very common, and sort of peculiarity with the most recent recession. Generally, when economic recessions happen, there was one, in the famous Rust Belt recession that particularly affected the upper Midwest back in the late 70s and early 80s, a recession in the early part of the 2000s, fertility rates dropped. But then once the economy improved, fertility rates started going up again. What's been unusual in the last 10 years since the Great Recession is the fertility rates never rebounded. So it's been something it's been a conundrum for those of us who particularly are trying to take fertility rates and trying to do projections into the future, because this is a pattern that just is really basically unknown in any prior history for us.
I saw some longer term trends. I think this is national trends in an older piece that you had done. And we saw the birth rate being pretty high in the baby boom. I guess no surprise there. And it really stabilized, and it never bounced back up from that that really intense period of people having a lot of kids, I guess.
Right. Yeah. The baby boom period, which for demographers, it started in 1946, the first year after World War II, and extended to 1964. And what happened after the war was, it was true in Wisconsin and nationally, the number of births increased like 20% in 2 years. So, for example, Wisconsin went from, I think it was about 60,000 births in 1945 to 83,000 births in 1947. And to think about it, the population of the state was much smaller at that point. So the birth rates were much higher. And at its highest peak in Wisconsin, that total fertility rate that I talked about got up over four in 1960.
Talking to David Egan Robertson, applied demographer at the UW Applied Population Laboratory, looking at birth rates here in Wisconsin. The number of births last year, or in 2017, I should say, the lowest since the early 1970s. We're looking at why that is and some of what that's going to mean for the future. Now, David, I know we've talked in the past. You're agnostic about the meaning of this. You don't say it's good or bad when we see birth rates go up or down. But let's talk about some of the possible consequences. One you were touching on earlier, Wisconsin's labor force, retirement communities wondering, okay, in 20 years or whatever, are we going to be able to hire people to work for us?
Right, right. Yeah, and one thing that we've particularly noticed at the Applied Population Lab, another program that we offer are school enrollment projections for public school districts, mostly in Wisconsin, some in Illinois. But what we've seen in doing these projections just the last couple of years is the lower birth counts that have occurred since the Great Recession. Those young children are now starting to enter, you know, school age, kindergarten through about second grade. And so when we're looking at the a district's history, we can already see those declines happening for school districts. You know, and certainly you start looking a little further down the road, you know, think about high school graduates probably out, you know, in the middle part of next decade. Things should stay fairly steady till about 2025 or 26. But beyond that, we'll start seeing fewer high school graduates. And again, sort of the long the labor force issues, you know, that gets a lot tied up, of course, with public policy as to, you know, what are we actually going to do about immigration in particular? And, you know, that gets into a national policy issue. You know, we look at our work as demographers as sort of here, you know, we want to inform the policy, but we let other people make those choices.
And do our school districts looking for this kind of demographic information to have plans for 5, 10, 15 years to know roughly how many kids they're going to have entering school?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a very serious issue. I mean, it's, you know, as I said, statewide, the number of births over the last 10 years fell about 11%. But you look at it out at some rural counties, it's down as much as 25 or even 30% in some counties. And so, you know, there are school districts that are looking at, okay, can we keep, you know, and particularly rural districts tend to be very spread out. People want to keep, you know, school districts in their villages. And in some cases, they may be looking at, okay, we have four or five elementary schools in our district. Can we really keep those all open? We've had a couple districts over sort of in suburban Milwaukee area, elementary districts that have recently merged because, in part, I think, because possibly they were looking at a decline in enrollment in coming years.
I'm going to dig deeper into some of those rural numbers. That was a huge drop you were talking about in birth rates. How much of that is because declining fertility, we're having fewer babies, versus there are fewer young people of prime childbearing age still in those communities?
Oh, that's very much a large part of it. Yeah, an effect of the Great Recession, and again, something, there's been some recovery, but not a lot that we're seeing, and we're talking about 10 years out, really, or 8 years out, 8 to 9 years out since the end, official end of the recession. In particular, you know, there's still areas that are struggling, and one in particular, there are a lot of rural counties in Wisconsin that may have a small sort of central city or village, and, you know, 5,000-10,000 people, and some you know, sort of historical manufacturing base. A lot of those counties are still struggling to sort of either keep up their population or to get enough in-migration of young people. So yes, right, that is still an issue, right? If you don't have sort of families moving in, sort of the prime ages of sort of 25 to 34, it's very hard for the number of children to also grow in those areas.
We've talked about state and national numbers. You mentioned global trends as well. And I've heard stories anecdotally about places like Japan or Hungary, other countries worried about the replacement rate. Are they going to have enough? Because Russia, I think, is another one. Are there countries around the world that you're watching and seeing similar things happen to what we're seeing in these Wisconsin numbers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I guess depending on your viewpoint, whether this is good or bad, that fertility rates are dropping. You know, our rate here and nationally is about 1.8 children per woman is the current total fertility rate. But if you look at, say, European countries, the European Union, for example, their average is 1.6. So that's quite a bit lower. And some countries like Italy and Spain, Portugal, I think, are down around 1.35. So they're going to struggle a lot more. Japan is around 1.4. Some countries, have more open immigration policies. For Japan, it's a serious issue because just culturally, they've never, and they're beginning now, but for a long time, they haven't been very open to outsiders coming in to be part of the workforce.
I've read a fair amount of history books, and some historians really make the point strongly. Okay, it's fun, watch the kings and queens and what they're doing. What's really driving things is these underlying demographic trends and how they are really, they reshape economies. How important is it to watch what's going on with our population changes over time?
Yeah, I mean, certainly you sort of touched on this a little bit earlier. We can sort of cycle back is the labor force issues. the baby boom generation now is the oldest are 73, and sort of the youngest of that group would be about 55 now. A lot of those people are entering retirement, or they're, you know, working part time rather than full time. So that, you know, is having a big implication. The number of workers who you could say are coming into the workforce not numerically be enough to replace those workers who are exiting for retirement. Again, we hear stories about, well, are more robotics going to be in our future?
And we should ask about the other end, I guess, of demography, death rates. What are we seeing? What's the latest you've seen in Wisconsin or around the United States when it comes to how long we're living?
Yeah. I mean, it's been an issue of great concern, particularly in the last two or three years, where for a long time, we could assume that life expectancy was increasing in the country. Certainly, there are differentials in terms of race and Hispanic origin. But generally, the pattern for, decades and decades was that life expectancy was increasing. And just recently, particularly, it's very sad, the opioid epidemic, we have something like 70,000 deaths due to opioids, I believe, now annually, and just a phenomenal number when, there are 30,000 deaths due to car accidents. Things like that are really sort of impacting our overall view of, okay, how is the age distribution of the population changing? Hopefully we'd inform the policy, okay, what can be done in terms of the opioid crisis and issues like that?
Just briefly, one more point in some of the latest numbers I didn't want to pass up. Teen birth rates going down significantly, is that right?
Yes. It's pretty interesting. The rate since 2007 for teens in Wisconsin has dropped by about 60%. Similar at the national level, down about 56%. So that's really part of the large decline in our number of births. That actually about half of the decline, if you look from 2007 to 2017, about half of the reduction in births is actually due to, in a sense, fewer births to teens during that time period.
Interesting. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
David Egan Robertson is an applied demographer with the UW Applied Population Laboratory and at the UW-Madison Department of Community and Environmental Sociology. He joins us today to talk about the latest data showing Wisconsin's birth rate declining over time. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the president is in Vietnam. Michael Cohen is testifying, and Congress is tackling the National Emergency Declaration. We'll find out more in our weekly roundup of national politics. And you used to call me on your cell phone. Before that, it was your dial phone, then your hand crank phone. We'll meet a Wisconsin couple who have been collecting antique phones for years. That and more all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, we hear a lot of economic news, but does it have anything to do with our everyday lives? Patty Hirsch from NPR's Planet Money joins the show with some life lessons in practical economics. It's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a journalism expert says the media should ditch the horse race coverage of elections and ask citizens what they want to hear candidates talking about. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.